We just need to finish up this chapter so we can be ready for exam three on Thursday. We've already talked about slide 26, so we'll go on to 27. We're in the middle of surveying connective tissues, and this gives you an example of hyaline cartilage. Now, cartilage itself, cartilage in general, is connective tissue, but there are three major types of cartilage. Hyaline cartilage is one of them. The other two are fibrocartilage and elastic cartilage. But we're looking at hyaline cartilage right here, and the word hyaline means glassy. And that's actually what it looks like. You don't really see it so much on this, but if you look at a real slide, it's a photograph of a slide. If you're actually looking through a microscope, it looks like bubbles within glass. And hyaline cartilage is the most abundant of the three cartilages. So most of the cartilage that's in your body is hyaline cartilage. Actually, there's less than there used to be, though, because almost all of your bones start out as hyaline cartilage that look just like bones. They have the same shape, but they're made out of cartilage first, early on in development. And then that cartilage ossifies, turns into bone, and therefore gets a lot harder. And most of that is done by the time you're born, but not all of it. So you still have soft spots on your skeleton that are not yet ossified. They are still harder than most connective tissues. Cartilage is pretty tough stuff still, but it's not as hard as bone. Anyway, that's a big part of where hyaline cartilage is. Even after your bones ossify and become officially bones, tips of the bones, though, where joints form, where one bone meets another, which is what a joint is, those tips remain coated with hyaline cartilage. So that hyaline cartilage lasts throughout your lifetime. It doesn't ever turn into bone. And that's because hyaline cartilage provides a nice surface with not very much friction, which is exactly what the joints require. Now, I'm talking about joints that are highly movable. So most of the joints we think of when we talk about joints are highly movable, like knee or elbow or whatever. But joint refers to any place where two bones come into contact, including the sutures that hold the individual bones of your cranium, part of your skull, together. Those aren't movable, right? You don't want those to actually move. So that has a different material in between them. But the highly movable joints have hyaline cartilage between them. And you also find a bunch of hyaline cartilage where the ribs in front meet the sternum, the breastbone. If you look at a skeleton, whether it's a real skeleton or just a fake model of a real skeleton, you'll see bands about this long of kind of translucent brown stuff. That's the hyaline cartilage. Well, remember we talked about the three types of cells that you find in any connective tissue: sites, blasts, and clasts. If we're talking about cartilage in particular, then we use chondro as the prefix, because that always means cartilage. So a chondroblast is a type of cell that produces this glassy extracellular matrix. A chondrocyte is that same cell a little bit later, after all the spaces have been filled in and it's basically just sitting there. And really what happens is that these chondrocytes lock themselves into a little prison, because they're completely surrounded by this extracellular matrix that's pretty tough stuff. And cartilage is avascular, just like epithelium is. So there aren't vessels running through the cartilage. And since these cells are locked off because they're surrounded by this really, really thick, not a complete solid, but a very thick gel, basically, they have to rely on, since they're not right next to blood vessels, they have to rely on diffusion through this very thick stuff to get materials in and out of the cell. And that's the thickness of that extracellular matrix really makes that a slower process than usual, which is exactly why cartilage is the slowest stuff in your body to heal. It takes even longer than bone, because bone is completely solid. It's even thicker stuff. But because it's completely solid, diffusion wouldn't work at all, and therefore bones have to have blood vessels running through them. Cartilage doesn't. All right, so and then that's chondroblasts and chondrocytes really are the same cells at different stages, and then there are the other kinds of cells, chondroclasts, that break down that matrix. All right, let's go to fibrocartilage now, slide 28. As the name implies, fibrocartilage has in its extracellular matrix quite a heavy density of fibers, a lot of fibers in fibrocartilage. And you find this between certain kinds of bones, including between the vertebrae that make up the vertebral column. When you hear people talk about a disc, a slipped disc, for instance, which there really is no such thing, strictly speaking, it's a herniated disc. These discs don't just slip out of place. They're really anchored well to the bone, but they can herniate and stuff inside of them can come out the walls. Anyway, the discs that they're talking about are intervertebral discs, and each intervertebral disc is made out of fibrocartilage. The bone itself, the vertebra, the part where the disc is connected to is called the body of the vertebra. And it is, if you look at it in isolation, you take the fibrocartilage away, you can see that the top and bottom surface of this body of the vertebra is really rough. And that's because that gives it a lot of places where the fibers of this fibrocartilage can grow into and get a really good anchoring. This is the same reason why if you're gluing two pieces of wood together, you don't want them to be perfectly smooth, right? Not just wood, anything. You know, you glue something to metal, you rough the metal up first. Give it nooks and crannies for the glue to take hold into. Same way with bone connecting to fibrocartilage. And that's why discs don't slip. They can get torn, but they stay in place. And what causes the pain is that the interior of this, which is called the nucleus pulposus, it gets squeezed out, and all in this area are a bunch of nerves. So when that presses on nerves, it causes a lot of pain. Anyway, that's fibrocartilage. And elastic cartilage is the third and final type of cartilage. Slide 29 shows you an example. The pinna of the ear, which is really, you know, when we talk about ear, we usually are only talking about what we see. That's not really much of the ear as an organ, though. That's just a funnel-like exterior that collects the sound waves. The working part of the ear is deep in our head. But when we say ear cosmetically, what we're really talking about is the pinna, and that's made almost entirely of elastic cartilage. As the name implies, it's elastic, which means if it gets deformed, it'll spring back into shape. Right, you bend your ear down, it doesn't stay down. It's elastic. And the reason it is elastic is because the extracellular matrix of elastic cartilage, which of course includes fibers like any extracellular matrix, well, those fibers are mostly elastic fibers. Remember the three different kinds of fibers we talked about that any matrix can have. Collagenous fibers, elastic fibers, or reticular fibers. Well, in elastic cartilage, it's mostly elastic fibers that you find, and therefore the cartilage overall is elastic. Okay, that's cartilage. Let's go now to bone, which is slide 30. And bone is the hardest of the connective tissues. And there are two major types of bone, which are called compact bone and cancellous bone. Cancellous bone is what you see on slide 30. Another name for cancellous bone is spongy bone. And that's a name that applies only to its appearance. Spongy bone is not soft like a sponge. It's just full of holes. So when you look at it, it looks like a sponge, but it's still hard stuff. You can't compress it. You can't squeeze it like a sponge. Cancellous is the more anatomically correct name, though. So cancellous and spongy mean the same thing, but cancellous is what we're using here. And any bone that you care to look at, like this is a femur bone, the largest bone in the body, the thigh bone. If you just isolate the bone and look at it, you won't see cancellous bone, because cancellous bone is found only deep inside it. In other words, cancellous bone does not occur on the surface of a bone. What you see on the surface is the other type of bone, compact bone. But if you saw it so that you can see a section of it, this is a cross section, a longitudinal section, I mean, you can see the yellow outer surface, that's all compact bone. But the interior of it, which is also bone, is the cancellous bone. And notice that it's full of holes. It kind of looks like a sponge. Well, in flat bone, you know, that's a typical long bone. In flat bones, you still see cancellous bones in the interior, though, like a flat bone, like a skull, like a cranium bone, for instance. It really is kind of like a sandwich, where the two slices of bread are compact bone, but if you look inside and between those two layers is cancellous bone. Now, in a long bone, the spaces that make cancellous bone spongy in appearance are filled up with marrow. That's where we find marrow. So if you take a bone out of something that has just recently died, you know, not a dried bone, but a fresh bone, and you make this kind of section, you won't see it just like this, because that all those little spaces will be filled with marrow. So it'll look like it's solid. But really, the bony part of it is just part of what you're seeing. And if you remove all that marrow, then you'll see these cavities. All right, let's go to 31 and look at the other type of bone, which is compact bone. It's called compact bone because it packs a lot of bone material into a smaller space. In other words, it is much more dense, a lot more mass per volume in compact bone. It is therefore much stronger, which is why you find it on the exterior surfaces of bones. That's where forces are directly applied to bones, so that's where it needs to be the strongest. And the way that compact bone is arranged microscopically is different from cancellous bone. Cancellous bone is made up of a network of little girder-like things, or little, they're called trabeculae, which really means little girders, but they're like little rods. So it's a network of all those, kind of like branches on a tree, or girders in a building that's being erected, although they're not in perfect squares. Whereas compact bone is arranged in little units that are called osteons. What we're looking at here is a photomicrograph of just one osteon. Each osteon has a central canal, which is where blood vessels and nerves run through, and then build up around that layer by layer. And I don't know whether you see the layers, but there's concentric layers of boniness that are called lamellae. And there's very little space in compact bone compared to cancellous bone. So that's what makes it a lot tougher. The small dark spots, not the central canal, but all these other dark spots, are cells, bone cells. So remember, any connective tissue has cells and extracellular matrix. Well, the cells here get the prefix that means bone, which is osteo. So here we have osteoblasts building up the extracellular matrix. We have osteoclasts breaking it down, and we have osteocytes maintaining it. So these are osteocytes that are locked into their own little chambers. But I don't know whether you see the detail here occurring radially. So as like each one is like a radius of the circle. These tiny wisp-like lines, those are little tunnels that go through the bone itself, the extracellular matrix. The extracellular matrix, by the way, is very hard stuff, and the main reason it's hard is because it's made of a mineral called hydroxyapatite. Which is calcium phosphate mostly, and that's why calcium is important for your bones. That's what makes it hard, but if these cells, these osteocytes, were locked into their own little chamber, just like chondrocytes are, then they wouldn't be able to live because they're surrounded by stuff that's completely solid, so they couldn't get any nutrients coming in, they couldn't get rid of any wastes, right? They can't live in isolation like that. So they have to communicate with each other by touching each other. Now the cells aren't right next to each other, but there are tiny little canals, hollow canals, that are going through this hydroxyapatite, and the chamber that you find one cell in is called a lacuna, which means little lagoon, right? So it's nothing but a space, really. If you were to remove the cell, there would just be a space there, like Swiss cheese. That's the lacuna, the space, but the cell fills up the lacuna. Well, the little canals that run from lacuna to lacuna are called canaliculi, which is the plural of canaliculus. A canaliculus simply means little canal. All right, so if I draw it, if this is one lacuna, this is another lacuna, there's a cell filling up each one of these. Well, a canaliculus runs between the two, and it's hollow. And so the cell in the lacuna isn't just that shape like a normal cell is. It's fills up that whole lacuna, but then it has a little extension of itself that goes about halfway down the canaliculus. And the other one has an extension of its cell that goes halfway down and meets. So the plasma membrane of this cell meets the plasma membrane of the next cell halfway down the canaliculus. And then there will be a next one in line and so on. Well, one of these cells is pretty close to one of the blood vessels that can bring in nutrients and can receive waste. So that one that's right next to the blood supply will take in nutrients and get rid of waste, but then it'll send some of those nutrients to the next cell through these canaliculi and so on, so that all the cells can get their nutrients, and then the waste is sent the other way till eventually the cell closest to the bloodstream dumps it into the bloodstream. That's how they can stay alive.
Are there multiple of those?
Yeah. I don't know if there... Yeah, I think there are probably several, but I mean, there's no...
It just looks like them in pictures.
Yeah, and I'm just drawing one by simplicity, but I don't... There doesn't necessarily have to be more than one. There has to be at least one, though. That whole thing, though, is one osteon, and we're looking at it in cross-section, so we're looking at the... kind of like a... the cut stump of a tree. But the intact tree is long, right? Well, each osteon is long also. And so a single osteon is kind of like a straw in a box of straws. When you get a box of straws, they're all next to each other, right? But they're all parallel. Well, a bunch of osteons in parallel make up that whole layer of compact bone that is so strong. So we're looking very close up. Many, many osteons next to each other form the thickness of this compact bone. All right, let's go to 32 now. We go from the hardest connective tissue, bone, to the least hard, which is blood. And we're including in here hemopoietic tissue as well. Remember that hemopoiesis is the process of producing blood cells. And hemopoietic simply means producing blood cells. So there is tissue that produces all of the blood cells. There are different kinds of blood cells, though. There are red blood cells, which are by far most of your blood cells in general. This slide gives you an idea of that. When you look at a slide of blood, almost all the things just look like empty circles. Those are the red blood cells. But then every once in a while, if you move the slide around, you'll see a much bigger cell, and there's different varieties of those. But all of them collectively are white blood cells, the bigger ones. And then there you can break white blood cells down into five major types and keep breaking those down. We're not going to talk about that here, but there the two major types are red and white blood cells. And by the way, the reason that the red blood cells look just like empty circles here is because there is no nucleus in the red blood cells of mammals, including us, of course. Birds have red blood cells that do have nuclei, but our blood cells don't, which is unusual for a cell, right? Well, for a eukaryotic cell. Prokaryotic cells don't have nuclei, of course, but we aren't prokaryotes. We're not bacteria or archaea. Well, actually, red blood cells start out with nuclei, but then they get rid of them. Why would a red blood cell get rid of its nucleus? Exactly. To make room. And what it's making room for is even more of what red blood cells carry, which is hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a complex protein. We've looked at it before. It's made up of four subunits, two alphas and two betas, making up one molecule of hemoglobin. Well, there are millions and millions of hemoglobin molecules just in one red blood cell. And there are tens of billions of red blood cells in your bloodstream at any given moment. So there's a whole lot of hemoglobin molecules. But the more hemoglobin molecules you can pack into a cell, the more oxygen and carbon dioxide that red blood cell can carry. And that's the job of red blood cells. It picks up oxygen from the lungs and carries that oxygen to the cells that need the oxygen and then dumps it off. So the more hemoglobin that's there, each hemoglobin individual molecule can carry up to 4 oxygen molecules. So if you can pack in more hemoglobin, you can carry more oxygen efficiently. And that's why in the course of development, they lose their nucleus. But whether it's a red blood cell of any of the 5 major types, or it's a white blood cell of the 5 major type, or it's a red blood cell, any of these blood cells come from the same kind of stem cell. A stem cell is simply a cell that can develop into any of several different kinds of cells. Well, the stem cells are in the marrow. They are the hemopoietic cells that make up the hemopoietic tissue. So the stem cells in the marrow are stimulated into becoming either red blood cells or white blood cells, depending on what's needed at the moment in the body. And red blood cells are continuously being manufactured. You lose billions of them each day, just in the normal course of living, whether you cut yourself or not. You lose billions of red blood cells because they can't live very long without a nucleus. They don't have any nucleus, therefore they have no library of how to make proteins. They can't repair themselves. They stand up to a lot of abuse because as they get pumped around the bloodstream, in the bloodstream, through the vasculature, they have to squeeze through a lot of tight spaces. Now, arteries and veins are big tubes, but the smallest tubes are the capillaries, and they have to be small so that the cell can be right up, the red blood cell can be very close to a cell that it's exchanging oxygen and carbon dioxide with. In other words, so diffusion will work well. So capillaries are so thin that they're even smaller in diameter than the red blood cell itself is. Which means when the red blood cell goes through there, they go through in single file, and they actually have to get squeezed through a smaller diameter than they are. They get deformed, in other words, in that process. Well, that is a lot of wear and tear on a cell. So not only are they not able to repair themselves, but they get damaged quite a bit. So they end up mostly in the, they get broken down in various places, but a lot of them end up in the spleen. The spleen basically recycles, gets rid of the old worn out ones, and as we lose them by the billions each day, billions of new ones are created by the hematopoietic tissue in our marrow so that we maintain the same amount day to day. All right. Oh, by the way, blood seems like it's a, well, seems to some people like it's an exception compared to other connective tissues. But it still has the same basic components that any connective tissue does. And remember that those two major basic components are cells and matrix, right? Well, the cells are obviously there. What do we call the matrix of blood? The entire tissue is called whole blood. That includes this, the cells and the matrix. But what is just the matrix called? In other words, for blood specifically, though. In other words, if we take whole blood and we remove just the cells, what do we have left? It is fluid, but what's it called? When you take whole blood, you put it in a centrifuge. The centrifuge, when you spin it...
Plasma?
Yeah, exactly. The heaviest stuff is the cells. Those get spun to the bottom of the tube. And if you remove those and you're left just with the liquid that's floating above them, that's plasma. So plasma is the extracellular matrix. Now, extracellular matrix of any connective tissue, remember, includes not only ground substance, but fibers. And remember, I said the fibers are proteins. So there's all kinds of proteins that are dissolved in the plasma, which is why we call them plasma proteins. They carry things around too, like hormones, for instance. Some hormones get carried by plasma proteins, and other things get carried around too. But if you were to take plasma, so you've already removed the cells, and if you spin it even faster in a centrifuge and get rid of the proteins, or the biggest proteins at least, then you have just the ground substance because you remove the fibers. What is that stuff called? Anyone know? It's also liquid, but it's thinner than plasma because some of that thickness of plasma comes from all these proteins. What is it? No, the platelets actually are fragments of cells, so they get removed as part of the cells as well. That's called serum. That's the difference between plasma and serum. So the whole tissue is called blood. That's made up of cells and extracellular matrix. The extracellular matrix is called plasma. That includes, like any extracellular matrix, ground substance and proteins. When you remove the proteins, you're left with just the ground substance, which in the case of blood is called serum. Okay. Bone marrow is shown in 33, and bone marrow really comes in two major varieties, yellow marrow and red marrow, which are found at different places in the skeleton. But yellow marrow is really just fat. It's fat cells or adipocytes. So that's what makes it look yellowish in appearance. So that's connective tissue itself, just because we've already talked about adipocytes. But red marrow, which you find at the tips of long bones rather than the shafts of them, red marrow is completely different stuff. It is the hematopoietic tissue. So blood cells don't come from yellow marrow. Blood cells come from red marrow. Okay. That is connective tissue. So that just leaves two major tissue types, which don't take as long to go through because there aren't as many examples of each. But those two remaining things that we haven't talked about are muscle tissue and nervous tissue. I've mentioned them when I listed the four. And what did we say these two have in common, muscle tissue and nervous tissue? They not only have it in common, but the other two don't have it. What is the property called? You're correct that action potentials are involved, but what do we call the property of being able to produce action potentials? Yes, they are excitable tissues. So muscle tissue will do first, since we're at this slide. And muscle tissue, of course, makes up muscles. But there are three major classes of muscle tissue. There is skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. Now, skeletal muscle gets its name from the fact that that's what is connected to bones, so that when the muscle shortens, like any muscle does, it pulls on the bones and allows us to move around, moves our skeleton. And so, really, when we talk, the vast majority of the times we talk about muscles, we're really referring to skeletal muscles. Like when you work out, that's what you're trying to do, is improve your skeletal muscles. But there's also smooth muscle, and smooth muscle is found lining several organs, including all of the organs along your alimentary canal or your digestive tract, all the way from your mouth to the anus. That's lined by a layer of smooth muscle. And smooth muscle, it works a little bit differently at the microscopic level, but it's still muscle, and therefore it contracts. Muscle in general, I should say, has four major properties. One of them we just mentioned, that's excitability. But muscle also has contractility. In other words, the ability to contract or get shorter. And that's all muscles can do on their own. In other words, you don't use a muscle to push anything. All you can use a muscle for is to pull on something. Now, of course, you can push on the wall, for instance. But when you're doing that, you're still using a muscle to pull on something. When I push on the wall, what I'm trying to do is straighten out my upper limb, right? But the reason I'm doing that is because my triceps is pulling on the elbow, straightening the elbow out. So muscles can only get shorter on their own. To get long again, they need to be either pulled by something like another muscle or by gravity. They can't get long on their own. So anyway, excitability, contractility. You also have extensibility, which makes it seem like... Which makes it seem like muscles can get long on their own to extend, but that simply means they can be stretched by gravity or by the force of some other muscle. You know, not all tissues can be stretched, but muscles can be. And when they get stretched and then whatever force is stretching them is removed, they will rebound somewhat. So they also have elasticity. Those are four major properties of muscles, muscle tissue. Okay, so we've talked about skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. That leaves only the third type, which is cardiac muscle, and cardiac simply means of the heart. So that's the only place you find cardiac muscle. The bulk of the heart is muscle. Well, it's probably about half and half, muscle and connective tissue. But the only muscle you find in there, if you were to remove all the connective tissue, all you'd have left is cardiac muscle. There's not skeletal muscle in there as well, or smooth muscle. And what you... Well, I have a better slide to show you the differences in how the cells are arranged, so I'll just go on. Slide 35 compares the three types of muscle. Each row is a different property, and that property differs when you compare the three types. I've already talked about location. The three types of muscle are located in different parts of the body. The shapes of the cells are different for the three types of muscles, muscle tissue. Skeletal muscle cell, by the way, the name of a muscle cell is, well, one way, one name is muscle cell. Obviously, that's one name for a muscle cell. But another name for a muscle cell is myofiber. Or muscle fiber. Muscle fiber, myofiber, and muscle cell all mean the same thing. They're referring to an entire cell, but only a cell. So what we call a muscle, a whole muscle, like the biceps brachium, for instance, that's made up of many, many individual myofibers. Well, anyway, the shape of a myofiber depends on which type of tissue you're looking in. For a skeletal muscle, the myofibers are cylindrical, which means, like little cylinders, they don't taper at the ends. They remain the same diameter all their whole length. They're also very, very long compared to most cells. Right? Most cells are microscopic in all three dimensions. But a muscle cell or a myofiber can be as long as the entire muscle. So if you consider the rectus femoris in front of the thigh, that's one muscle cell that whole length. And many of them side by side make up the bulk of the muscle. They also don't branch in skeletal muscles. So it's one long cylinder with no branches. Well, cardiac muscle cells are also long. They're not as long, but compared to most cells, they're long. They're also cylindrical, so they don't taper on the ends. But they do branch. They don't have to, but they can have branches on them. All right? Smooth muscle, on the other hand, is tapered at the ends. So a single cell is spindle-shaped. A spindle is something that's thicker in the middle and pointed at the ends. So that's what the cells look like. Now, where you find the nuclei of these cells differs also in the tissue types. In a skeletal muscle cell, you have many nuclei within the one cell. So that's kind of the other extreme compared to red blood cells. Red blood cells don't have any nucleus. In other words, they are said to be enucleate, which just means without a nucleus. On the other hand, a skeletal muscle cell has several nuclei. They are multinucleate cells. And the reason that is because they're so long that to have one centralized nucleus would rely on a lot of traffic going from the nucleus to the other parts of the cell. So they have a little nucleus each, you know, like rest stops along a highway, basically. The reason that comes into being, by the way, is because these very long skeletal muscle cells actually start out as individual cells stacked end to end. And then they fuse into one long cell eventually. But each nucleus used to be the one nucleus of an individual cell in that group. Peripherally located means located along the edge. When we look at a picture, you'll see this, but most of the interior of this cylindrical cell is made up of the myofibers, myofilaments, I should say, that are what is responsible for making a muscle cell get shorter. And so the more you can put into that, the more efficient the cell is at doing its job. But that doesn't leave any room for the nucleus, which is usually right in the interior of the cell. It pushes the nucleus to the edge, and you kind of see it as a bulge on the edge of this cylinder. Cardiac muscle cells, on the other hand, since they're not nearly as long, they just have one nucleus, like most cells, and they're centrally located. Just same thing in smooth muscles. Striation refers to the banding pattern that you see if you look at these things under a light microscope. So bands of light and dark over and over are striations. And two of the three kinds of muscle are striated. Those two are skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle. But skeletal muscle is almost perfectly striated. It's more beautifully and orderly, more orderly arranged. And in fact, older texts used to call just skeletal muscle striated. And they used to be interchangeable terms. But the reason that the striation is so nice on skeletal muscle cells is because the cylinders don't branch. So the striations are all lined up. When you have branching, you have striations going in opposite, in different directions, and therefore it doesn't look as orderly. Well, smooth muscle interiorly has a different arrangement of those myofilaments, so they don't have striations. How the muscles are controlled is also different. Skeletal muscles are under conscious control. They are voluntary, meaning that you decide that you want them to contract. Right? You have to make the conscious determination to lift something or to do any sort of skeletal exertion. That's because whether your skeletal muscle moves is up to you. It's up to what your brain. On the other hand, you don't, thankfully, you don't have to remember to beat your heart. Cardiac muscle is under unconscious control. It's involuntary. The autonomic nervous system takes care of that behind the scenes without you having to worry about it. And same is true for smooth muscle. It's involuntary. You don't have to remember to propel the food through your digestive tract. Smooth muscle does that on its own. By the way, the cardiac muscle is not only involuntary, muscle making up the heart, it also has autorhythmicity, which means that it will contract on its own, even with no input from a nervous system. Your skeletal muscles will not work at all without neurons sending action potentials to them, telling them it's time to contract. Well, you have neurons running to your heart as well, so you can adjust the rate of your heart, depending on exercise needs, with your nervous system. But even if you were to cut off all nerves from leading to the heart, you know, if you rip a heart out of the body, it will continue to beat on its own until it runs out of energy. That's autorhythmicity. And smooth muscle is autorhythmic as well, but much more slowly. Smooth muscle contractions are long, drawn-out contractions that last a lot longer, but they're not as strong either. So the job of smooth muscle is to propel stuff through a hollow organ, like the digestive tract. Okay. I just talked about the ability to contract spontaneously. Function I've already discussed, and special features I've already discussed as well, except for these gap junctions. I'm not going to talk about gap junctions, but I want to talk about specialized junctions between adjacent cardiac myofibers. So cardiac myofibers are like branched cylinders, right? And when you get two of them end to end, they're still separate cells. But when one cell fires, meaning contracts, since this is the heart, you want all the cells in that same chamber of the heart to contract at the same time. That way it operates as an efficient pump, right? You don't want individual cells contracting at one moment and then other individual cells contracting at the other moment. You want them all to contract at the same time so that that whole chamber gets small and squeezes the blood through it. Well, these end-to-end attachments between cardiac myofibers are called intercalated discs, and they allow for an action potential, which is that electrical signal, to travel directly from one cell to the next one. So they all are synchronized. Let's look at some pictures now. 36 is close-up of a few skeletal myofibers, and notice that they are not branched, and they don't taper. They're unbranched cylinders, and notice they have multiple nuclei along the length, because this is all one cell here, and that those nuclei are pushed to the edge. They're peripheral. The banding pattern is the striation. And when you look at a real, this was a drawing, of course, but this is a real photomicrograph, the banding is nice and perfect because there's no branching. So it's highly striated. When you look at cardiac myofibers, they are branched, but they're otherwise very similar to skeletal muscle cells, except they're not as long. And so every place you see one nucleus, that's a different cell. These dark bands right here, I don't know how dark they are out there, darker than these striations. These dark bands are where one cell ends and the next one starts. Those, in other words, are intercalated discs. All right. So notice that in the real picture, it's not nearly as beautifully striated, and that's because of the different directions, because of the branching. When you look at smooth muscle, individual cells are tapered. They're spindle-shaped, like I said, but still just one nucleus centrally placed, and you don't see striations because their internal anatomy is different from the other two. All right, that's muscle cell, and that leaves only muscle tissue. That leaves only nervous tissue, which is the other type of excitable tissue besides muscle tissue. And there are two different classes of cells that make up nervous tissue, shown here in slide 39. There are neurons and there are neuroglia. Now here it's just listed as glia. If you put neuro in front of that as a prefix, you have the word neuroglia. Neurons, one type of cell, there's different kinds of neurons, of course, but neurons make up one of these major classes of cell types in nervous tissue. And neurons are the excitable cells in nervous tissue. They're the only excitable cells. So we say that the tissue is excitable, but that's only because of neurons. So neurons, a single neuron is just another name for a nerve cell. The word nerve never really refers to just one cell. Just like muscle does not refer to one cell unless you say muscle cell. Right? A muscle is a macroscopic big thing made up of many, many cells. So is a nerve. But if you want to talk about one cell within that nerve, one excitable cell within that nerve, you either call that a nerve cell or even better, a neuron. All right. So those are the cells that actually receive and send impulses to other parts of the body, including other neurons. The other cells collectively are called neuroglia, and they're not excitable, so they don't create and transmit action potentials. Their job is to, in one way or another, support the neurons. So they do that in different ways. So there's five or six major classes of neuroglia, but I'm not going to go through those. I just want you to know that neuroglia in general are supporting cells that make up the rest of nervous tissue besides the neurons. So if we look at a couple pictures, only a couple slides left. Slide 40 shows you a typical neuron. It's more than a neuron here, though. The neuron is all of this purple octopus-looking thing and all the yellow part that runs through these other three things. But that's it. That's the neuron. These three things that look like little wrappers around the neuron are neuroglial cells. Okay? So there's four different cells shown here. And there would be more of these neuroglial cells, but it's been cut off. So neurons, just like skeletal myofibers, are very long cells. Now they can get away with being so long without violating the surface area to volume ratio constraint that we talked about, which doesn't allow cells to grow big. Well, that doesn't allow cells to grow big in all three dimensions. So a cell can't get very long, very wide, and very deep all at the same time. Neurons can get extraordinarily long. It's one cell that goes from the tip of my toe to my spine. It's a very long cell. But it still has a high surface area to volume ratio because at the same time that it's very long, it's very thin and very narrow. So there's still a lot of membrane to serve that interior cytoplasm. Okay? Now, if you look at a typical neuron, it has some major parts to it. Where you find the nucleus, and also the biggest part of the cell itself, that's called the cell body. So this is the cell body, and that's where the nucleus is. And connected to that cell body, well, it's all part of the same plasma membrane, but what looks like connections to this cell body are dendrites. Dendrites are inputs. They're receivers. So they receive stimuli from other cells, like other neurons, and then all the dendrites send those impulses toward the cell body. So these are receivers. And then coming out of that cell body at one place is a very long axon. Now the axon might or might not branch, but it only connects with the cell body at one place. So it starts as one. It could have branches later on. Maybe not, though, also. And axons can be very long, which is why the overall neuron is so long. But axons are outputs. So depending on what the inputs being received are at the cell body, the axon might or might not create an action potential right here at this connection place. And if it does create an action potential, then that action potential travels down the length of the axon, and whatever is connected to the neuron at the other end will receive that information.
Is there only one axon?
Per cell there is. But like I said, it could branch. So a single axon is still able to send the same information to multiple cells, like in your skeletal muscles. We call that whole group of one neuron plus all the cells that it connects to, one motor unit. So a single motor neuron with one axon can have many branches, but each branch will go to a different myofiber in the skeletal muscle. And therefore, every time that neuron fires, every one of those individual myofibers will contract. The neuroglia of different types do different jobs, but the neuroglia that are shown here are accomplishing the job of myelinating this axon. Some axons are myelinated, some aren't. But myelination simply means coating an axon with what is called a myelin sheath. Well, the myelin sheath really is a cell that wraps. You know, unfold this cell that's right here. If you were to unfold it, it would be a long, kind of like a long piece of tape. And so its plasma membrane is kind of like a long piece of tape, like I said. But then you wrap that several times around the axon at one place in the axon, kind of like wrapping toilet paper around the roll. The cardboard roll of toilet paper would be this little section of neuron, and then the toilet paper itself would be the cell that's wrapping around it. That cell that's wrapping around it is not the neuron, it's a different cell, it's a neuroglial cell. But by wrapping around it, it myelinates it, which electrically insulates it. And this allows the electrical impulses, these action potentials that any neuron can send down its axon, it allows them to travel a lot faster than if it's not myelinated. Because it just has to jump from one place to another instead of going continuously. That's a lot faster. All right, so that's one use of neuroglia. You also can see some neuroglia in this final cell. The neuron itself is the yellow material. And its cell body's here. Then it has a yellow axon that is branching. But all the purple stuff here on the surface, except for the interior surface of the interior of the cell body, that is neuron. But all of these similarly purple colored things that are on the surface, those are all individual neuroglial cells that cover. This one happens to be in the central nervous system. So the overall nervous system consists of a hierarchical arrangement. It consists of central nervous system, which is the brain and spinal cord, and then the peripheral nervous system, which is all the rest of the nervous system. The previous slide, 40, this is a neuron that's in the peripheral nervous system. So slide 41 is in the brain somewhere. And so they have different kinds of neuroglia covering the cells that make up those neurons. And that's, I think, the final. Yeah, that's the end of the chapter. And therefore, it's the end of the unit, which means now it's time for what I've been warning you about from day one, the hardest test. So don't skimp on studying. I mean, you know the routine by now, but if you have not ever tried, like I've recommended on the website, of studying by giving your own lectures out loud without looking at anything, the best chapter to do that for is the previous chapter, cellular respiration. Well, more than just cellular respiration, the complete breakdown of glucose, because that's a whole process. So it's a perfect thing to try that technique with. If you can start with glucose and go all the way to carbon dioxide and water, and along the way say what happens without looking at anything out loud, then you're doing well. But if you try it and you find you can't do it, that means you're not ready for the test. So for that reason alone, try it.